Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Face it, you're a neo-maxi Zoom dweeby. What would you be doing if you weren't out making yourself a better citizen?
Nice.
The Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me, the neo-maxi Zoom dweeby.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1985 in our I Love the 80s journey. How you feeling about it, Don?
Good. We're halfway there.
Living on a prayer. Next year, yeah. In 86.
But we are at the midpoint of the decade.
That's true. Things are starting to get scary. The 90s are coming. And I feel like this is the point when we start building toward that, you know, musically. All right. So this is, of course, the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums in the album format. Don's thoughts.
Yeah.
Couldn't have taken a while. And we just love talking about them, and that's what we do here. So we got a great show for you today. We're continuing our I Love the 80s journey and going year by year. So we're covering 1985. Don and I will each be presenting an album today from 1985 in the rock or R&B space as dictated by the Wheel of Musical Discovery. And then, of course, Don will be asking us a deep question. Oh, mind-rattlingly deep. Then we'll have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging. And then we will spin the wheel of musical discovery to learn what types of albums we'll be discovering in 1986. But that's for next time. This week, it's all about
1985.
That's what I'm talking about.
Tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union are overshadowed by cola wars as America turns its back on New Coke. Wood-paneled TVs glow with larger-than-life images of Don Johnson and B. Arthur. Chunky new camcorders feel like space-age gadgets, and Michael J. Fox is taking us back to the future. Today, one of us drops the needle on a towering rock record from 1985, and the other sinks into a silky R&B groove from that same year. So put some bagel bites in the oven, grab a handful of Sour Patch Kids, and cue up a night of VCR Clue. This is 1985.
What about Nerds? Sour Patch Kids? I didn't even know those. Never heard of those as a kid, but I do remember Nerds from about 1985 or 6.
Yeah, I think Nerds were introduced before that.
Willy Wonka, man. I don't know why it came out that way. So yeah, there was a lot to consider here in 1985. Many things we've talked about on the show before. Dire Straits, Brothers in Arms.
That's a good one.
Big selling album, Money for Nothing. Tears for Fears, Songs from the Big Chair, one of, I think, probably the best albums of the 80s, in my opinion. And we talked about that not too long ago. You love that one too, right?
I do like that one, yes.
John Mellencamp, Scarecrow. I freaking love that album so much. I grew up on that one. That was the one that made me feel like I was listening to something more meaningful at that time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
What other rock stuff were you thinking about, Don?
Well, of course, The Cure, The Head on the Door, one of their, bigger albums. In Excess, Listen Like Thieves.
That's a good one.
R.E.M., Fables of the Reconstruction, The Smiths, Meet His Murder. It was a good year for rock.
Who's gonna do? I feel like you've got to say who's gonna do? Like a Scottish guy, I don't know. Not sure why. Maybe Fat Bastard loves that band.
Get in my belly!
In the R&B space, we had Whitney Houston with her self-titled debut, which we did talk about on the show. Freddie Jackson, Rock Me Tonight. Pretty good record. I was pretty impressed by it. Wasn't quite what I was looking for, but it was nice, smooth.
Sade had an album, Promise, which I think was a very good album.
It's so clean. It's just so clean. Saxophony, adult contemporary.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And, of course, Prince had a big album pretty much every year of the 80s, yes. So Around the World in a Day, which we covered at some point.
We did in one of our many Prince discussions. I would have loved to have been able to do that one, but them's the breaks.
Yes.
All right, the picks are in. It's time to fire up the flux capacitor and get back to 1985. Let's get to our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
My pick for a rock album from 1985 comes from The Cult and an album called Love. It's their second album. The Cult is a
George Washington was in a cult, and the cult was in the aliens. Daisy Confused reference.
Yes. So the Cult are a British rock band formed in London by vocalists Ian Astbury.
Put the T in there, friend.
Astbury.
To put the T in. I had never even thought about it that way until you until you ruined my brain.
Vocalist Ian Astbury and I thought
get the T.
Astbury. Ian Astbury and guitarist Billy Duffy. So, you know, kind of a, you know, it comes out of the post-punk world, I would say, but also has some classic rock vibes and maybe, you know, some hints of, you know, the other kind of glam rock and stuff that's going on in the 1980s. Here's the opening cut, Nirvana.
Very nice.
Yeah. So Nirvana is written by Ian Astbury and Billy Duffy. Kind of upbeat, sort of a celebratory tone, not as dark as some of the other tracks on the album. Kind of the theme of finding transcendence through music and escaping sort of our mundane everyday existence. This one actually feels a little bit more kind of straightforward rock to me, maybe a little less post-punk from other stuff on the album. But yeah, it's got, you know, kind of a driving rhythm to it that I like. And yeah, I think it's an excellent opener to the album.
Yeah, I mean, looking for something spiritual in music, you know, and I think that is a like a mission statement of this band at this time and specifically for this album. And I love that. I love that it's like being clear that this is what music can do. I found my space. Can you find yours? Mm-hmm. I feel like maybe they're trying to present that to us here. But it does have a direct rock sound, balanced mix. But they are shifting from post-punk and goth influences are here. More so than on their first album, I think, which was not nearly as interesting as this one. Not bad, but it didn't feel like Nirvana was at my fingertips, and it does from listening to this. It does set the stage for this elemental shamanesque, you know, vibe woven into all the songs and kind of set the Cult apart from their goth and post-punk brethren. It's something new out of the scene.
Yeah, it's much more spiritual, I think. Whereas, you know, a lot of, you know, post-punk was more just about darkness. Even a band like Killing Joke was, I mean, they were sort of hinting at, you know, Satanism and stuff like that, you know. So this is, you know, coming from a different place. All right. Well, here's another cut on the album. Here's Brother Wolf, Sister Moon.
I thought I was going to ask you, like, what drew you to this song? Was it this sort of earthly elements of the wolf and the moon and all that? But then as soon as I heard the guitar part, I knew it was a Pink Floyd thing, isn't it?
That definitely did catch my ear.
I mean, it's barely.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's at the point where if there's, like, any kind of haunting solo, it's like, oh, that's Floyd.
The earlier parts of the song actually reminded me of Alice in Chains, and even his vocal delivery kind of made me think of Alice in Chains. So Brother Wolf, Sister Moon, again, was written by Astbury and Duffy. It references St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle of the Sun, which addresses elements of nature as a spiritual kin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting that an English band was, you know, particularly interested in, like, Native American spirituality, because that's, you know, in this song and others.
I mean, to get into that just a little bit, so Ian Astbury did move to Hamilton, Ontario in 1973 at age 11, lived there for 5 years, but he went on a school trip to Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve, and this is where he became fascinated with Native American culture and became friends with kids that lived there. And even in the early days of, like, the bands previous to the Cult that he was in, he wore, like, the garb and stuff. So he definitely very connected to it, not unlike our friend Jim Morrison, who also had fascination with that.
Absolutely.
So
yeah, the whole presentation is, you know, as if he is like a shaman,
yeah,
or something like that.
It is mystical. Like I picture him with a wolf head thing, you know, pelt on or something, sitting in front of a fire. But yeah, the psychedelic textures are here also, though, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's just such an interesting mix of things, of feelings, like music that brings out emotion.
Yeah.
It's very evocative, this album, all the songs.
Yeah. And again, I think that differentiates it from some of the other, you know, stuff in this realm at the time. It just feels more natural and just like more emotional and raw, and there's an energy to it. Okay, well, is there a cut you wanted to talk about?
It's a song we kind of have to talk about. It's the one that broke them loose. I think that people recognize if you say The Cult and they're like, who? This is one that helps get them along to the right place. It's called She Sells Sanctuary. So this one really successfully bridged that post-punk with mainstream, what was becoming alternative rock, where I think some of what alternative rock at that time as it was developing was that it was about other stuff than I love rock and roll or getting chicks or, you know, I think that was part of what set it apart, was subject matter was getting a little more off the beaten path. And this takes a new approach on sex. You know, sanctuary, like sex being a place to recharge and hide in this, this place that's away from all the pain of the world. Instead, it's pure, you know, joy and enjoyment and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's not chauvinistic or anything like that. Yeah.
No, when I was young, I thought it was about like prostitution, but it absolutely is not, because of the cells. Mm. It's about what this, you know, this feminine mystique brings as a sanctuary from everything. Did you read anywhere that Steve Brown may have accidentally been hired as the producer on this?
That he was accidentally hired? No.
Yeah.
No.
I had read and heard that Steve Lillywhite and Steve Brown worked at the same whatever. Yeah. And that a demo of this song was dropped on a desk labeled for Steve, and that there's stories out there that the wrong Steve picked it up.
That's funny.
Lillywhite was the intended recipient, supposedly. I don't know if it's true, but it's an interesting possibility.
Yeah, I like that idea. Yeah, I mean, this has become sort of a post-punk anthem. The riff and the driving bass line reminds me of, you know, some of the more aggressive Joy Division sounding songs. But the, you know, particularly the vocals take it to a different place. Yeah, it's a tremendous performance, I think.
But musically, this song really like captures some of the elements of The Cure and bands like that. That gothy stuff, the U2 jangly guitar stuff, but harder. And then The Doors with the mysticism and the word, even using the word sanctuary is poetic. And of course, Jim Morrison was a poet first. And so I don't think it's a direct, like it doesn't sound like The Doors, but elements of some of the best kinds of rock music, in my opinion, are in this. And that is exciting.
Yes. All right, well, let's, as we always do, talk about the closing cut. Here's Black Angel. Yeah, so this one's, you know, kind of a, you know, a lighter, slower tune, you know, to end the album, you know, because there's just so many just kind of really driving, rhythmic songs, you know, in the middle. Yeah, and this one, you know, kind of ends on a more chill vibe. That actually kind of reminds me of something maybe some of the, you know, the hair metal groups, you know, could have done. Not the lyrics, but the, you know, just the vibe of it.
I think it's too introspective.
Yeah.
To it being used by any band as a power ballad.
Right.
Because and it doesn't have the big, like, soaring guitar solo that remind you that it's a rock song. You know, I think it's a fugitive contemplating long travel and accompanied by this black angel that's the protection, or maybe it's death, but
yeah. It's definitely deeper than, it's deeper than Wanted, Dead or Alive.
Yeah. And like, life is long or short, but you have this specter either protecting you or waiting to take you. And, and it's a heavy way to end the album. And I think that's fitting because this album is emotionally heavy hitting while keeping you bobbing your head. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose if they had Mutt Lang or something, maybe you would have gotten the...
But instead of rage or excess, the cult leans into atmosphere, repetition. But, you know, but it's like in a good way, in a tribal way, not in a lazy way. But this album, this song, it's about transcendence and finding unity through emotion and ritual and shared experience. And it's cool.
It is.
It's a good closer.
All right, well, let's rewind and reflect on the cult's love. I'll begin with my clickbait headline. Don and Dude's musical interests had a baby and named it The Cult. So I do think this is a good pick for both of us because, you know, obviously I think it comes from a place that I'm comfortable with, you know, that Cure and Joy Division sounding stuff. But I do think it has maybe a more raw emotional element and rhythm that I think you're more into.
It's also, it's emotive, but more masculine, if that makes sense, like in a traditional masculinity way, I guess, where it's not as, I don't want to say whiny, because I don't want to dismiss the Cure and stuff.
It's less whiny.
But it's not like feeling sorry for yourself vibes aren't here.
Right.
It's more about exploring who you are, and I think that's cool.
That's a good point.
My clickbait headline to describe love, atmosphere over aggression. The cult's love gives birth to a new kind of heavy.
Wow. We both gave birth in our
We did. I can't say for sure, but I feel like this type of stuff may have helped in terms of what happens in the late 80s, early 90s with Pearl Jam.
Yes.
And the Seattle bands and Alice in Chains, all of that, where there's this more inner exploration stuff in a hard rock exterior.
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't occur to me until this week listening to this, how it might have informed grunge.
Yeah. I'm not saying that it created it, but I think music like this, this kind of blend of harder rock with the Cure type, you know, post-punk sensibility may have been, at least lyrically, I think.
Yeah. Particularly like Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Killer to Filler. I gotta say, I love this album.
It's awesome.
Yeah, and maybe I'm finally ready for it. But you know,
maybe you're all grown up.
Yeah, but God, you know, songs like Phoenix is awesome.
Yeah, the way that he sings fire.
Yeah.
Fire.
Again, it's that repetition stuff. You know, I mean, the chorus is fire. But it's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think it might be tied to that kind of spiritual chant type vibe.
Yeah, and Love and Rain, both of those are kind of in a similar vein.
The guitar riffs on Love. I mean, we got to talk a little bit about that. Billy's guitar is essential here to balance out Ian's poetic, artistic journeys and the vocals. There's such a nice balance there. And Billy does want to be a rocker. He wants to let that guitar loose. And there's some restraint here. And I think that is part of what helps it work.
Yeah. Yeah. One interesting cut is Revolution.
Love it.
You know, it just... And for a moment, it kind of reminded me of like a John Mellencamp song, you know, just the kind of the refrain. And I think there's like some acoustic strumming in there. It kind of had sort of an organic vibe, which I liked.
It's got a first person perspective, assertive, strong and defiant, you know, like it's like a call to arms. And I think maybe that's, and I'm not sure exactly if the revolution is musical, revolution of your soul, you know, of letting free and being who you are. Like, I think it depends on who you are when you're listening to it, like what that means. But it does feel like a, you know, fist up in the air type of moment.
Yeah.
Hollow Man is awesome.
Yep.
The reflection on emptiness and the search for authenticity, which I think artists and musicians in particular, wanting to be big, but also wanting to be real. Muted guitars, heavy reverb, and that works really well too. Hey, did we didn't mention this. I just want to mention this one thing on an obvious banger of She Sells Sanctuary, that the guitar texture that Billy used, that D string, G string melodies stuff, the drone technique, I guess it's called, inspired by Indian classical and psychedelic rock. But then there was that mistake at the beginning, the accidental setup where Duffy left his entire effects chain on, and that's where that sound came from at the beginning. They didn't mean to do it.
Yeah.
But it's so iconic and necessary for that song to capture you. I just think the happy accidents are something that I love in the creative process, and you're not going to get that if we continue to let AI make songs and records and stuff. That's, you're not going to have that.
Right.
And we need that. That's human, and that feels special.
Yeah. All right. Production. Well, it was produced by Steve Brown, not Steve Lillywhite. You know, Brown has actually worked with like Wham and Manic Street Preachers. So he had done sort of British pop and, you know, very commercial production, but also some harder edge sounds. I don't know. It just sounds great. You know, they captured the vocals well. The vocal sounds so good. You know, the rhythm, the guitars. I don't know. It's so well done. They ended up like moving on to big producers like Rick Rubin and Bob Rock, I think.
They should have stuck with this.
Yeah.
The vocals do sit slightly back, which I think gives it sort of a chant-like quality.
Yeah.
It avoids dated 80s production tricks. It's timeless. It's organic sounding.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, because of the nature of it, gothic and whatnot, I picture them recording like in a cathedral or something. I'm sure that's not the case. But the production makes the album feel alive and atmospheric and ritualistic. And it's really about the vibe over flash.
Yeah. So I agree. Replay value? Yeah. I mean, this is one of my favorites now. How about you?
I've been loving it for a long time, but I love it more whenever you have to look at it from a perspective where you're going to talk about it exhaustively.
Yeah. Right.
It either enriches or takes away and makes an album seem, oh my God, this is not what I thought it was. So this is more than I thought it was. And I will definitely be going back into the rest of their catalog too.
And I just like the charismatic frontman, you know, that persona. And the way he sings is really not like anybody else, you know, particularly in the 80s, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Legacy, I don't know. So, it kind of sat in this interesting place, you know, between goth and post-punk and new wave and sort of your more traditional sounding rock. It's a bit of a hybrid.
What's coming after.
Yeah. But it's kind of tied together, I think, by this sort of spirituality, or at least this quest for spirituality.
It
kind of gives it a light, you know, among sort of like the darkness.
I think it demonstrated that dark music could be commercially successful without compromise. And it also kind of teaches rock to, again, how to be mysterious.
Yeah.
How to be spiritual. Not those things existed at other times in the history of rock, but I think it reminded us in the mid 80s among all this neon glitz and MTV and the way we consume and learn about music changing. This reminded us that let's connect, you know?
Yeah. All right, well, the Cult's Love captures a band standing at a crossroads, turning brooding club music into something bigger and stranger. Does it speak to you in 2026? Drop the needle and let us know.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Well, it's time again for Deep Questions by Don. All right, so when we get to 1985, I think both of us are probably more aware of, you know, the world of music, and we're starting to form our own tastes. So what significant music-related moments or developments occurred in 1985?
Well, I think a bunch of different stuff did, of course, but I feel like Live Aid, which we did do an episode on some albums from a couple of years back, but Live Aid, the event, was so impactful.
Yeah, so you know, Live Aid was a benefit concert that kind of built off of, you know, the two charity releases, the Band Aids, Do They Know It's Christmas, and USA for Africa, We Are the World. So this was all the brainchild of Bob Geldof. Yeah. So, yeah, they did this huge benefit concert in two locations. It was interesting, kind of the two centers of the popular music at that time. So you had Wembley Stadium in London and JFK Stadium in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Well, that whole via satellite thing really is when I became aware of it. So I watched the telecast on live TV on ABC. I think it was a Saturday and it was in the evening. I know the event had been going on all day on MTV, right, Don? You were watching that?
Yep.
So I saw what was meant to be the prime time biggest acts part. And my family, we had a, you know, my dad grilled a bunch of food. My mom made a bunch of stuff and we got to sit on the couch and eat at the same time. Amazing. Not at the table like we always had to. But it was an event and they were into it. I was into it for different reasons. I was looking for different artists and they were, although I think we both agreed that watching Phil Collins perform in both places. He took a jet so he could perform in Philadelphia and in London.
Mm-hmm.
And he played drums for the short-term reunited Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I was quite excited by it at the time because I was very into Duran Duran. And so, interestingly, they were playing at the Philadelphia venue. And it also, the Power Station, which had John Taylor and Andy Taylor, they were performing kind of earlier in the day. And then towards prime time is when Duran Duran came on. And, you know, that was sort of the highlight for me. But then after that, I think you had like Mick Jagger and Tina Turner and...
I miss these moments where these shared cultural events that I things like the Olympics and stuff. I mean, I suppose to some degree, but now it's you can stream part of it, watch part of it later. Like knowing that there are millions and millions of other people sitting in front of their TVs and you're all viewing something at the same time across the world.
Yeah.
It was pretty special for me as a kid, and I loved music, and that this just helped to show me the power of it.
Yeah.
And it was so clear that we all love the same thing, and that's music.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine a show like this having the same sort of impact. You know, we can't even get people to agree to watch the Super Bowl halftime show anymore.
Right. Well, I don't want to watch it regardless of who's performing. It's boring. I just wanted to watch the football part. Right. No commercials. No halftime.
All right. So what other significant music-related moments happened in 1985? What do you remember about Live Aid? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook, at Album Nerds.
So I dug, and I dug, and I dug. I wanted to find R&B record that, obviously, there were things we couldn't talk about because we already had, but I wanted to find something that was a little less known, although pretty well known, and I feel like it was impactful to the future, like... We knew we were doing The Cult, and The Cult, as I was listening to it, it inspired me to look for something that maybe was helping to move R&B forward, as I thought The Cult was helping to move rock music forward. So I went with Ready for the World. Ring a bell? American R&B and funk band from Flint, Michigan, formed in the early 80s by vocalist Melvin Riley and guitarist Gordon Strozier. Joined by Gregory Potts, Willie Triplett, John Eaton, Gerald Valentine, and others, all within the Flint, Michigan music scene. I guess they were all like competing against each other in talent contests, you know, in the city, and they came together for this project.
Must have been something in the water.
It was clean then, maybe. The sound is heavily influenced by Prince's Minneapolis, you know, the Minneapolis sound, like the bands like... The Time, Morris Day and The Time. Ready for the World built their sound around a mix of R&B, soul, funk, contemporary pop. And then, you know, I think we start to hear some new Jack Swing beginnings here as well. So the self-titled album was released on May 14th, 1985. The record captured that distinctive sound and independent creative control of the group. This is self-produced. They did all the work themselves. Why don't we kick it off with the debut single from the album called Tonight? Oh, 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 girl, tonight. So we start getting into it, right?
Sure.
Like, this is, especially for the time, I mean, it, because of things like Little Nicky by Prince, I think they felt like they could push it a little bit. And this is.
They did.
Pretty sexy.
Yeah.
Well, depending on if, like, leaning on cringe.
Yeah. Well, it's weird. I mean, these guys are young, right? I mean, these are
like late teens, early 20s.
And some of these songs were written when they were in like ninth grade. So, you know, there is kind of like a
immaturity.
Yeah.
So, unlike a lot of R&B acts of the era, I mean, this was just them. And I think because of the lack of funds, they were using synths, drum machines, and traditional instruments, bass, guitar, etc. But R&B at the time, they had to have horns.
Yeah, that's amazing.
They couldn't afford horns, you know? And I feel like that DIY perspective is part of what makes this special and stripped down and starts the path toward what I think, you know, we were hearing from Bell Biv DeVoe and other groups a couple years later. Yeah. And this electro funk sound. And I mean, the song itself obviously is about emotional and physical connection. Like, have you made up your mind? You want to make love tonight? Like, it's listen to it alone or listen to it with someone who won't laugh. But it's great. I mean, it's sort of dirty, but it's really pushing things into this, the R&B of the late 80s and early 90s. And that's really what I was looking for here, was something interesting, something real. And I think that's what they were doing. So moving on, why don't we listen to a little bit of another sexually charged song, but with a different sound, Human Toy. Great sounds. I just feel like the bass and the, I like that live feel of saying drummer. It's very Prince-y.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But I don't know. It's just a fun listen. I just enjoyed hearing it.
Yeah, I got the sense, or I guess I expected that they were more just like a boy group that were put together, you know, by some
like
producer.
New Kids on the Block or something.
Yeah, and they're not at all. I mean, these guys, you know, I think these ideas were all coming from their heads or through their love for Prince. And yeah, I mean, they kind of know what they're doing. You know, it doesn't sound like a bunch of young boys.
Stop saying that.
Sorry. but the metaphor is fun. You know, the idea of just being a toy, you know, that a woman can use for her pleasure. No directions necessary. She knows what to do. it makes me uncomfortable, but you know.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if we talk about their, you know, it's all hormones at that age, and they at least were expressing this in a safe way.
Right. Of course, you know, I mean, AC/DC had cringe lyrics too.
Yeah, of course. But this, because it's clearer.
Yeah.
The mix of synthy and drum sounds and rhythm changes and stuff adds something more naughty to it for some reason.
Well, it feels like it's being deliberately seductive, you know, whereas, you know, I don't think AC/DC is trying to seduce, you know, with...
No. Yeah, but I mean, they use elements like the Yamaha DX7 electric piano and analog polysynths and stuff. So it does sound of the mid-80s as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a good thing. I think R&B was kind of stuck a little bit in the more Lionel Richie, you know, and Prince helped push it. But Prince was more rock and roll too, you know. Mm-hmm. So Prince was pushing things in the direction these guys kind of took off with the vibe, and it's good stuff. So Don, a song you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, well, I think we should talk about the one that I knew, you know, from Top 40 Radio. Oh, Sheila. Sheila, let me love you till the morning comes.
Oh, Sheila. This is the reason this album sold a million copies.
Sure. Yeah, I guess, you know, a lot of people at the time, I probably did too, thought it might be Prince.
That never even occurred to me. I heard it on the radio and it didn't sound... I mean, it sounded cool, but I don't remember thinking it was Prince.
The little rhythmic part, the bang. Bop, bop, bop. You know, that kind of sounds like something Prince would have done.
Yeah, but, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, and that drum sound too, that electronic drum sound has a Prince-y feel.
Yeah. There were rumors that this was referring to Sheila E., you know, who also lived in that Prince universe, but apparently drummer. that was false.
Yeah. Yeah. And Melvin Riley Jr., the singer and co-songwriter on this, said that it was just, it sounded good. It fit. They were looking at Lisa at one point, as the name there, but she lives.
Lisa.
Just,
I guess it would
work. What do you think about his British accent thing at the beginning and then at other parts? And he said he just thought it sounded cool and it sounded nice coming out. And I thought maybe it was like an Australian thing, and a Sheila is an Australian slang for a girl or a chick.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was because, I mean, there are some
Sheila
in there somewhere. There are some new wave vibes on this album a little bit, and so maybe, I don't know, maybe that just came out naturally when you're doing new wave sounding stuff. I don't know. Who is the rapper we did with the faux? Dana Dane.
Yes. Yeah. It's not unlike that. That's a really good point. I forgot about that. Yeah, I mean, this is a defining R&B pop crossover hit, and I think some of the beats or the kind of beats it might have been in hip hop. So that, I think that's where this is where the ideas started forming of this hip hop R&B hybrid that we later get in the New Jack Swing era. I don't know. This just does feel like an important song in the evolution of the sound.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And I wouldn't have thought I'd say that.
Right.
When I was like, hey, maybe I'll do the Oh Sheila Dudes, and I listened to the whole record. I'm like, yeah, they got something here. But it is of its time. Mm, so
for sure.
Let's close it out with the final track on the album, I'm the One Who Loves You. I love that synth and guitar.
Yeah.
Little riff there. So it does another romantic affirmation, I suppose. Yeah. But it builds on the warm interplay of the rhythm and the harmony, and it centers on the emotional commitment and devotion. This one seems a little less sex-driven, a little more relationship-y.
Sure.
A little.
Yeah.
But unlike Oh Sheila, it's not like that's about being driven crazy by this lady, and this feels more about whether love's being expressed physically or not. It's still, I'm the one who will... Who loves you?
Sure.
You
know? Yeah. His vocals at times, you know, like that part there. You don't want the money. Like, I could picture Prince, you know, singing that way. Yeah. But yeah, I think a lot of the R&B that follows in the New Jack Swing kind of has that delivery. Yes. It's more rhythmic than like the, because I was thinking about DeBarge at the time.
Right.
And it's different.
Yeah. It's driven by the funk, not the rhythm of the night.
Well said.
To the beat and the rhythm of the night. All right, why don't we take some time and rewind and reflect on Ready for the World. Let's kick it off with my clickbait headline. DIY bedroom vibes, drum machines, and Prince-inspired minimalism meet explosive full band electro-funk. Ready for the World contributes to the future of R&B and keeps you dancing.
Prince-inspired, I like that. We did an episode about
Prince-pirations. Yeah,
that's right. Prince-inspired. I like it.
And because that New Jack Swing babyface production style of the late 80s and 90s, you can definitely hear it starting to form mm-hmm. here. It's in its infancy. And it, at least for my ears listening to this, even though there was some silly sexual stuff, which is fine. It was about the vibe of the time. And it still was hitting notes where I was like, hey, this went somewhere. And I love that.
All right, well, I'll give you my headline. Horny boys from Flint use drum machines to turn late night fantasies into slick bedroom R&B anthems.
There you go.
You know, thanks to Prince, I think people just started becoming more overt with their, you know, their mm-hmm. sexual lyrics. Yeah, the more time I spent with the record, I think I just the more I appreciate the do-it-yourself nature of it. And
ironically, I don't think there were any songs about doing it yourself.
That's... but yeah, and I just respect that they wrote their own songs and they arranged and produced it all themselves, you know, maybe with a little help.
Yeah, very cool. All right, so Killer to Filler. I mean, this is kind of tough. I guess it's more about the ones you enjoyed or had mm-hmm. sonic high points. Digital Display, funkier, dance floor oriented, leans more to the electro funk side. They use some vocoder type sounds on the vocals, but again, it's, you know, mirrors the technology driven sound but explores the desire attraction using digital metaphors mm-hmm. through a contemporary lens, you know, but it does sound machiney and I like it
because of course back then digital just meant like you had a digital watch.
Well, you know, there was some of that like computer graphics stuff starting to hit pop culture.
One of those little tiger video games, the little handheld.
Yeah, the little red dots. Yeah. Yes.
Ceramic Girl actually mentions Ready for the World, the lyric.
I like that. Yeah. I don't quite understand the title, Ceramic Girl. I mean, like I was reading, it was like artful perfection and delicate fragility. Like,
sure. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. But ceramics are beautiful, but they're gentle.
Delicate.
Yeah. You got to be careful when you put them in the kiln.
You know, you don't want to blow them up or break them.
I like the one ballad, Deep Inside Your Love. And I think that was one of the...
Yeah, I wasn't sure where that was going to go, but it didn't get as nasty as I thought it was going to. So it was good.
Yeah. That was good. The other ballad, I think, was Slide Over, which was similar. I think they did a good job with both of those.
So all in all, I mean, filler-wise, I there are songs that are certainly weaker. I'm the One Who Loves You, perhaps.
Yeah.
But
Out of Town Lover.
Yeah, but it's really more of a 35 whatever minute experience, and the sounds and the vibes. It's tough to say anything as filler. It really depends on your taste. If you like this kind of thing, you'll just like it and lean into it and run with it. So production wise, technically savvy without feeling sterile. The production reflects the shift in R&B from live instrumentation to a mix of that and electronically enhanced arrangements. But the fact that it's self-produced, it just really aligned with their vision of sleek, contemporary R&B that was being formed at the time, and that's cool.
Yeah, they actually have something in common with Bruce Springsteen, because a lot of these actually were like the demos, and they didn't bother, re-recording them.
So it's like Nebraska, yeah. Not quite as culturally impactful, but, more so than I think people give it credit for. Replay value, Don?
I think as a conversation piece... You know, these guys produced their own stuff. You remember this? Yeah, it's not too bad of an album. But, when I'm just looking for something to, listen to, it won't be near the top of my list. But I'm glad I know it now.
The next time I'm in the mood to listen to some Bell Biv DeVoe and that, I might mix this in. Sometimes I'll spend a day just listening to that stuff. Bobby Brown and Color Me Bad and like that whole thing. I might throw this in the mix, listen to this album as well. It's usually on a Friday, it's closing out the work week. So maybe this week I'll have a New Jack Swing party and invite Ready for the World.
You're going to do like one of those cool haircuts with it has like an angle to it.
The flat top, the angle flat top.
Yeah.
They used to call it the Gumby.
Oh, that makes sense.
At least at my school. Legacy-wise, I think it paved the way for late 80s crossover pop, hip-hop, New Jack sounds. And in the meantime, they had a big hit that people remember. So that's Legacy. Oh, Sheila. I think everybody has heard that song.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I wouldn't quite call it a hidden gem. Because it had like a huge hit, and it sold a lot of records. But yeah, I'm not sure exactly where it fits in pushing R&B forward, but I think it does. I think they probably deserve some credit for it. So good for them.
All right. From slick synth grooves to unforgettable hooks, Ready for the World's debut takes its influences and pushes them forward using DIY spirit and electronic instrumentation to help develop R&B for the era. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
So in the DeLorean on the way back from the future, did you have a chance to dig anything else?
I did. This is something that kind of leans on the past. Band is the Molotovs. The album is Wasted on Youth.
When I first saw it, I thought it was Mazel Tov.
Ah, l'chaim. The Molotovs are a British rock punk, I guess, band from London formed by Matthew and Izzy Cartledge with Will Fuchs. Drawing on punk, new wave, garage rock influences, building a reputation through high energy live shows. I've seen them on Instagram for quite a while, doing covers and things, sort of a White Stripes-y vibe. So I've been looking forward to seeing what they do on an album, and it's here, Wasted on Youth. Why don't we listen to a little bit of More, More, More. Listen to it a couple of times. We'll see, I think it's worth a listen, and trying to find the Molotovs in the mix of the sounds that they're inspired by. You know, that's sometimes the challenge. So looking for their identity is what I'll be looking for. So next up, as always on this 80s journey, I've been trying to pick an album from my collection from the year we're talking about. And this is a band I don't think we would get to in any other way. So I'd like to mention Mr. Mister.
In France, they are known as Monsieur Monsieur.
Oui. Senor, senor, in Spanish-speaking countries. Yes, we could go all, we could do this all day. So Mr. Mister, an American pop rock band formed in the early 80s by session musicians, Richard Page, Steve George, Steve Ferris, and Pat Mastellotto, blending polished songwriting with lush synth pop and melodic AOR, or album-oriented rock type stuff. Welcome to the Real World is the album, second studio album and breakthrough. It had a couple of big hits, Kyrie, Is It Love, and also Broken Wings.
Take these broken wings and learn to fly.
So dramatic.
Yeah. It marries bright, sophisticated pop rock production with emotional lyrics. It's smooth, and I remember recording the songs off of Casey's Top 40 and things of that nature. But one of the things that at the time, I was still living in Nebraska, and Steve Ferris, the guitarist, was from my town.
Oh.
So people were making a big deal locally about the rock and roll hero. So
wow. I was hoping you were going to mention that it appeared on Silver Spoons. Where the Ricker got dumped or whatever. And so he's like lying on his bed listening to the song.
Oh, geez. So
very dramatic.
I would be more interested in talking about when Menudo was on Silver Spoons.
Yes.
What do you got, Don? What'd you dig in on?
A group called Soft Cult. They have they're.
Whoa. So is this
You know, it didn't even occur to me.
Adult contemporary reworkings of the Cult?
No, actually. So Soft Cult, they're Canadian twin siblings, Mercedes Arnhorn.
Hey, I had siblings too. What the hell?
Yeah, interesting.
Jeez.
So she's the vocalist and guitarist. And then there's Phoenix Arnhorn. Phoenix was a Cult song. Interesting.
Wow.
She plays drums and vocals too. Also a do-it-yourself vibe kind of... You know, influenced by grunge and shoegaze and Riot Girl. This is their debut full-length album. Here's a song called Queen of Nothing.
Thank God they didn't say the word sanctuary in there somewhere.
I may have not mentioned the name of the album. It's called When a Flower Doesn't Grow. But,
good title.
You know, explores, you know, some tougher, often, you know, female-oriented themes, sexual assault, personal transformation, misogyny, and stuff like that. So, yeah, I've spent a little time with it, and I'm enjoying it. And then another artist who I was not familiar with and just discovered is Bartiz Strange. And I got all confused. So it turns out, so I found this album Magic Boy, which was just released. But it turns out the material dates back to like 2017. And it's kind of like acoustic folk stuff that doesn't really sound like some of his, you know, full length work that has come since. But anyway, here's the album's called Magic Boy. And here's a song called Going.
I see what you did there. It's called Going, and then Gone comes in the... Nice. Actually, this just proves that you don't listen to me, because I did mention Bartiz Strange's album Horror back in 2024. Slap in the face.
That was on Diggin'? You dug it? Or, huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well, shame on me.
I guess it wasn't that interesting. I didn't present it properly.
It's funny, because after listening to this, I was listening to Horror, and God, I don't remember you. Are you sure you didn't just dream that you talked about it? Let's go to the archives. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of John Bender, portrayed by Judd Nelson in 1985's The Breakfast Club. And Bender said, "Hey, how come Andrew gets to get up? If he gets up, we'll all get up. It'll be anarchy." With that in mind, let's bring out the wheel of musical discovery to find out what kind of albums we'll be discovering in 1986. We'll be right back.
Next time, we continue our I Love the 80s series with 1986. Big pop hooks and fresh hip-hop energy take over as we dive into pop and hip-hop, spotlighting two albums that capture the year's flashy fun, bold voices, and growing cultural shift.
You down with P.O.P.? Yeah, you know me. Pop and hip-hop. See how I fuse those things together?
Very good.
It's freaking amazing.
I think there will be some fusion in that year, definitely.
I look forward to it.
All right, what are your favorite records from 1985 and 1986? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And you can visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 325 episodes. And the best way to support this show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you so much, as always, for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time in 86. Just walk this way.
Oh, all right. So this television show debuted in 1985. Ready? Spin me that record again. Don't waste another minute of your streaming.
There you go. Growing Pains.
Yes. Good show.
Of course. I mean, can't go wrong with Mike Seaver and
Mike
and his best friend Boner. That was a shocking thing.
Yes.
Loved it. His last name was Stabone, so it's fine.
That's right. Richard Stabone. And his dad, Sylvester.
See you in 86.